Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Film Show, running barefoot through the world of cinema. On this week's show, we're giving centre stage to the action monsters of yesteryear, a bunch of tired old fossils dug out of the rock and dusted down for a new generation. And if that weren't enough, we'll also be reviewing The Expendables 3. Rising up, back on the streets, Robin Wright takes a trip to cartoon land in Ari Folman's The Congress. Guy Pearce and Robert Pattinson ride hell for leather across the outback in the Rover, and one of our dinosaurs is missing. Whatever became of Dinosaur 13? First up, it's The Expendables 3, in which a bunch of hoary old action heroes embark on a mission to take out Mel Gibson. The young and sprightly Andrew Pulver sat down with two of the film's stars, Wesley Snipes and Antonio Banderas.
Go, go, go!
Great to have you back.
No better place to be.
You try to find that niche and that lane where you can, you know, still hold your own, not overdo it, but not get lost in the sauce at the same time.
The hell is that?
Insane.
Courageous.
But insane.
This is very classic. Action movie. Robert Rodriguez is a different deal. Robert Rodriguez, as Pedro Almodovar and all the directors that I've worked with, has a very strong personality. With Almodovar, you play what he exactly wants from you. And he may not give you too many explanations. Almodovar just invites you to participate in a very creative hell.
It can't be.
We were close once. We started this whole Expendables thing together, but we had a falling out.
You put a lot of yourself into it. Seemed to be a lot of lines that you might have fed into it. I was thinking particularly about the tax joke. I mean, did you write that yourself, or was that?
No, I didn't write that.
Right.
No, I just had to figure out a way to sell it.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. I didn't write that.
Right.
My first reaction to it when I read it, I was like, oh man, here we go. But when I thought about it again, it was like, okay, I can make this work.
I'm joined now by Peter Bradshaw and Henry Barnes. Peter, these Expendables movies are becoming a bit of a crowded party, aren't they? It's like an infestation.
Yeah, there are so many of them that the poster's starting to look like the sort of Sgt. Pepper album cover at all these people, because it's not simply that he sacks the old guys, he brings in the new guys, and then the old guys come back again. Mm. And even the young guys sort of start to look old just by osmosis, really. He sacks all his old crew for some reason that isn't quite explained to them, because he wants to bring in new guys, and they are literally expendable. He's sacked them, but they don't get upset or offended and they come back. Now, is that a deliberate irony or not? I really don't know. But the old guys are still looking old. I mean, Schwarzenegger, he looks like he's wearing some sort of gentleman's support corset, really, some of the time. He looks like literally walking is a problem for him now. Mm. And there are some things which...
Does that give a kind of pathos to the film?
No, not really, because this film would never acknowledge pathos. The idea is that they've still got it. That's the whole point. And I think the weird thing is that Sly Stallone still has it, actually. He's the one who's kind of still really unexpectedly kind of does have it. But there are some people who just look terrible. I mean, Jet Li, the very famous Chinese action star, is given this demeaningly infantile role. It's outrageous. It was just wrong, really badly wrong.
Henry, is it an insult to you?
No, I don't think it was an insult to me. I think Peter's slightly off in that I think there is pathos to it. I think, you know, Sly fires them out of love. He doesn't want to see them killed in the line of duty, so he gets in people that are genuinely expendable.
But isn't that an insult? He doesn't want to put them, but he wants to put them in the line of fire. I mean, I think if I was them, I would be insulted. It's as to say, you guys can't take it. I can, obviously, but you're not up to it. Am I wrong? Maybe I am.
What I loved about the film is the parallels. You've got things like Wesley Snipes' character being questioned about why he was in jail, and he goes, tax evasion. Yeah. And then they wonder why Bruce Willis isn't there, and he's not in the picture anymore, because Bruce Willis famously said he wanted something like $70 million to appear in another
Any jokes about Mel Gibson?
No jokes about Mel Gibson, but there is this massive tuba blast on the soundtrack every time he comes on, and it's really that kind of cinema where it's like you need to be told that Mel Gibson is a bad guy. And, you know, there's a final showdown between Sly and Mel, which I quite enjoyed in the, you know, two old dinosaurs taking chunks out of each other. I think if you kind of grow up with this in your DNA, there's something in your lizard brain that just can't resist the idea of Sly and Mel and Arnie and all these people, however old they are, taking massive swings at each other.
Well, I guess that's the USP of the film, isn't it? It's catering to a kind of an aging demographic, presumably.
Yeah, but I just thought that there are so many of them now, and their associations aren't entirely... I mean, Harrison Ford isn't really... I mean, he's an action star in a way.
Oh, he's a classy action hero.
But he's not an action hero in the way that Dolph Lundgren is or Jason Statham. The idea, what I used to find quite amusing about The Expendables is that they've taken these, frankly, second leaguers and promoted them in parallel with their kind of aging persona. I kind of get that, but there are so many things which I just think are extraneous. It was off the boil for me, really, to be honest.
I think what is interesting is that the next generation, the new guys that he brings in, they're not names at all. They're not Vin Diesel or The Rock or anything like that, which sort of says something about the shelf life of the franchise, I guess, that if these are the kids that are going to be leading it on into the next generation, you can't really see it going anywhere from this.
But this is already a long-lived franchise. I mean, this is like the action movie version of Blast of the Summer Wine, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is, and they're all Bill Owen, though. That's my that's my beef with The Expendables.
Hey, Barney, you should have killed me where you had the chance. You want the kids? Come get them.
Sly, Arnie, and friends raising a ruckus in their elephant's graveyard. We now move from one Expendable to another. Robin Wright is an over-the-hill actor. She's pushing 90 in Hollywood years, and all that remains is to take a trip to the Congress.
We want to scan you, all of you, your body, your face, your emotions, your laughter, your tears. We want to sample you, preserve you, and we want to own this thing called Robin Wright.
Animator Ari Folman blends live action with cartoon psychedelia to spin the tale of aging star Robin Wright, who sells the rights to her own digital image. Before long, her youthful avatar has become a top-grossing film star all over again. Though where this leaves the real-life Wright is anyone's guess.
How do I know if I'm dreaming?
Henry, Ari Folman made one of the best films, I think, of recent years with Waltz with Bashir. Back in 2007, I think, but this one slightly more problematic.
Yeah, Waltz with Bashir was the Oscar-nominated film about the Lebanon War in 1982, and I think because it was a documentary essentially, he could then take that factual basis and go free rein with it and use his imagination and create an animation that was both beautiful but also incredibly poignant and rooted in the real world. I think what he's done here is he's started to do a satire about Hollywood, which is very broad, not particularly insightful, and then spun that off into a bizarre dreamscape, almost, again, Beatles-esque Yellow Submarine-y animation, which, to be perfectly honest with you, I was baffled by. I didn't really understand what was going on once they got into the animated world of Robin Wright's future subconscious or whatever it was supposed to be. I think there's moments of beauty in this, and there's moments of insight, possibly, about the Hollywood studio system. I think you could compare Robin Wright in this to, say, the original studio stars in that they were controlled by studios and told to appear in everything that they could. But ultimately, I wasn't really sure what his message was, other than that we like celebrity and we like our celebrities young.
Well, there's also a sort of form and content problem here as well. I mean, maybe deliberately, that it's a film about the digital now that we're living in, and yet it's using this very old-style cell animation to show this world.
Yeah, like Henry, I found myself baffled. I didn't understand what that animation was doing. It just didn't look very good. I mean, considering how brilliant his animation was in Waltz with Bashir, and that was a movie which really did gesture towards the blurring of the lines between real and unreal and imaginary and digital and analogue and all those things, brilliantly controlled. And the animation itself was exciting and thrilling and immersive. And this just doesn't look very good, frankly. I didn't see it. I thought, is it going for some deliberately old-fashioned thing? Is it going for some kind of Ghibli pastiche? What is it doing? It just looked like something on a Saturday morning TV show in the 90s. 1970s, especially the simulacra of celebs who wander on, like Michael Jackson and Liz Taylor.
Tom Cruise.
I just thought, for the first time in my life, I found myself getting rather annoyed on Tom Cruise's behalf. I mean, God knows he doesn't need me or anybody else to take up the cudgels on his behalf. But why? It was just parasitic and presumptuous. I just thought it was crass. And it looked like Ari Folman really didn't know very much about the Hollywood scene, or about celebrity, because that sort of thing, it needs an incredibly sophisticated level, which the Americans have already brought to it, of wit and irony,
yeah,
and smart ass cynicism.
And he's just kind of Charlie Kaufman-esque.
Exactly. Whereas Ari Folman just where that should go, he brings this kind of bland, isn't this a bad thing?
Is it a kind of classic case of a director being kind of taken out of their comfort zone, that he obviously had this one great story to tell, and now he's stuck being a kind of jobbing director to a certain degree?
It might be that. I mean, it might be also that to him, Hollywood is genuinely interesting now, and movies are fascinating again, because he's finding a new way of making them in this giant system that will only let you usually make them one way. And a weird parallel I drew of it was something like The Streets, the musician, who made this first album where it was all about his so-called gritty day-to-day life. And the second album, he had to almost go back and make an album about that life again, but from the fantasy viewpoint of someone who's now above it and is a celebrity and will never ever be that person ever again. So I think you probably do lose sight of why you got into making films in the first place, and you have to find something else to latch onto in Hollywood. And he's found this, and he's found what he thinks is a cause. I'm just not sure that the cause is put across with much conviction.
Just make a choice and you feel whatever you want. What do you choose?
That's Robin Wright playing Robin Wright in The Congress. And in keeping with what seems to be the theme of this week's show, we now have a documentary about dinosaurs. Sue the T-Rex has been in the rocks of South Dakota for about 65 million years, but who actually does she belong to?
Crawl up on the cliff face, and I see three articulated vertebrae. And from that point on, I'm absolutely certain this is going to be the best thing we ever found, and it's going to be a complete T-Rex.
He called up and said, Neil, I need you to bring a lot of plaster 2x4s. Well, it took me a day to get everything ready, and I came up, and I got up there with all these materials, and he took me over to this big cliff, and he said, take a look. And I looked at it, and I looked at him, I said, is that T-Rex? He said, yes, and I think it's all here.
For the paleontologists, it was the find of a lifetime, the fossilized remains of a giant T-Rex, almost perfectly preserved on a ranch in the Badlands. But the rancher wants money, and the federal agents are circling. Everybody, it seems, wants a piece of Sue.
I believe that the tail's going that way, and the skull is going this way. But we're just going to have to dig it up and see.
Henry, it's a kind of knotty and interesting story here, but I wondered if it was quite knotty and interesting enough for a feature-length documentary.
Oh, wow. It's like a lumbering Diplodocus, this film. It takes so long to come over the horizon. It takes so long to pass your eyes that you feel like you've lived 65 million years by the time you've watched it. It is one of those films that you think it's an interesting story about petty politics, about people's passion for science and how that can often overtake what the clear-eyed view of what they should be doing in terms of their own self-preservation. And that is an interesting story, but it's an interesting story in a New Yorker article or a National Geographic article, I think.
Which can kind of tease out all the kind of really interesting meat of this film in terms of tribal land in America that's held in trust by the US government, and also in trust by what seems to be a fairly unscrupulous rancher as well. All of which is kind of interesting, but it's very hard to unpick in the guise of a kind of thriller, which is what this is effectively trying to be.
It's supposed to be a legal thriller, but I mean, it's not a legal thriller. If you think about something like The Case Against Eight, which was a documentary out, I believe, last year about gay marriage in California, and there's a real passion to that, obviously, because there's so much at stake and there's so much emotion behind the actual issue. I think no matter how much you love dinosaurs, it's really, really difficult to get passionate about Sue, who's been dead for 65 million years and is a lump of bones.
And yet they do. You know, the main paleontologist, Peter Larson, He's said to be like in love with her. And people are kind of breaking down weeping when they see them being separated.
And he was, I mean, in a slightly separate case to this, he was actually jailed for 18 months for doing his job, essentially. Mm. And he wasn't treated fairly. Mm. And again, that's part of this fascinating story. I'm just not sure that they really convinced me that I could be ever that interested in what they love so much. And that's tragic in a way, and it's probably not their fault. But I just couldn't care about dust and rocks and bones.
We were met by two FBI agents with a search warrant to take Sue and all records belonging to Sue. But they took everything. They went through all of our offices, all of our desks.
Unconscionable. I can't imagine somebody being able to do this. Here in the United States of America, in a free country.
People were so emotionally involved. There was a dream that the town had. It was our dinosaur. It was our lives that had been torn to pieces.
A custody battle with a difference in Dinosaur 13. And we end, appropriately enough, with the end of the world adrift in the post-apocalyptic wilderness of the Australian interior. This is The Rover.
Flies are buzzing and the engines are revving in David Michaud's The Rover. Guy Pearce wants his car and will stop at nothing to get it. He drags hapless Robert Pattinson along for the ride.
I think this played in a midnight screening at the Cannes Film Festival back in May, which is a kind of appropriate setting for it.
Yeah, I mean, it was, again, it was the expectations were very high for David Michaud after his cracking gangland thriller, Animal Kingdom. There are lots of things that are really interesting about this film. It's got a real sense of place and atmosphere and tension. And Guy Pearce is terrifically good in it because he really embodies what there is in the outback and the landscape he puts up on his face, that kind of grizzled, maniacal, blazing-eyed, sculpted integrity and intensity. And you think, these guys who've stolen his car, they're going to pay. The problem with the film, I think, is that it's got nowhere else to go, so it meanders around picking up weird little cameos on the way, these strange Diane Arbus, crazy, freaky, scary figures out there in the ruined post-apocalyptic landscape. And again, that's not without interest. Mm-hmm. But I was a little bit disappointed by it, really. I thought it didn't quite have the tension. I thought there were plot problems, you know, the truck versus the car. That doesn't quite make sense, actually, really. So I was a little bit cool about this, to be honest, even the second time around. But it certainly has the impact factor.
It's like a kind of shotgun wedding of Mad Max and Dude, Where's My Car, isn't it?
It's a bit. It's sort of like Mad Max without the kind of psycho zany vibe to it.
Yeah, steampunk kind of vibe.
Yeah, which was probably because Mad Max was actually quite cheap and B-movie-ish. And I think that this could have done with more of that, really. I think if you're doing a dystopian thriller these days, your dystopia's got to be pretty darn distinctive. Otherwise, we're all going to lose interest quite quickly. And I think, to this film's credit, for the first half an hour or so, it really holds your attention.
Yeah. And it's got a great atmosphere.
It's a fantastic atmosphere. And I think Peter's right. I think that is mainly Guy Pearce, who, again, is just really committed and almost extraordinarily in this role in a way that nobody else in the film is. This is essentially a really great short film. Yeah. With another hour stitched on the back end.
And when you finally realise what it is about the car, that's kind of a sort of Shaggy Dog joke, but it could have worked if it was a shorter film. It would have been really interesting, but the idea... And, of course, if the car actually was a Rover, that would have been good too. If it was an Austin Rover or something, that would have been fantastic too. But that idea, there's something about the car which we haven't explained yet. Again, I like that. That's really... I think that's smart and kind of funny.
But then it's got to pay off.
But then it's got to pay off. It's got to pay off in some sort of proportionate way to the colossal themes and colossal kind of aggrandizement which the film had been selling you until then.
I would say if you're going to go and see this film, you should skip the last 10 minutes and just leave the cinema because they make a dog's dinner of it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what God's given you. He's put a bullet in you. And he's abandoned you out here to me. He feels nothing for you. couldn't give a fuck if you died tomorrow. God gave you a brother who's not waiting for you. He gave you a brother who's not even thinking about you right now. Just because you and him come out of the same woman's hole. The only thing that means anything right now is that I'm here and he's not.
Guy Pearce and Robert Pattinson bringing this week's Roving to a close. My thanks to Peter Bradshaw and Henry Barnes. Thanks to you for digging us up and dusting us down. We're back next week.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.